Omnilingual by H. Beam Piper. Part 1. Martha Dane paused, looking up at the purple-tinged copper sky. The wind had shifted since noon, while she had been inside, and the dust storm that was sweeping the high deserts to the east was now blowing out over Syrtis. The sun, magnified by the haze, was a gorgeous magenta ball, as large as the sun of Terra, at which she could look directly. Tonight some of that dust would come sifting down from the upper atmosphere to add another film to what had been burying the city for the last 50,000 years. The red Lois lay over everything, covering the streets and the open spaces of park and plaza, hiding the small houses that had been crushed and pressed flat under it, and the rubble that had come down from the tall buildings when the roofs had caved in and walls had toppled outward. Here, where she stood, the ancient streets were 100 to 150 feet below the surface. The breach they had made in the wall of the building behind her had opened into the sixth story. She could look down on the cluster of prefabricated huts and sheds, on the brush-grown flat that had been the waterfront, when this place had been a seaport on the ocean that was now Syrtis Depression. Already the bright metal was thinly coated with red dust. She thought again of what clearing this city would mean, in terms of time and labor, of people and supplies and equipment brought across 50 million miles of space. They'd have to use machinery. There was no other way it could be done. Bulldozers and power shovels and drag lines. They were fast, but they were rough and indiscriminate. She remembered the digs around Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro in the Indus Valley, and the careful, patient native laborers, the painstaking foremen, the pickmen and spademen, the long files of basketmen carrying away the earth. Slow and primitive as the civilization whose ruins they were uncovering, yes, but she could count on the fingers of one hand the times one of her pickmen had damaged a valuable object in the ground. If it hadn't been for the underpaid and uncomplaining native laborer, archaeology would still be back where Winkleman had found it. But on Mars there was no native labor. The last Martian had died 500 centuries ago. Something started banging like a machine gun, 400 or 500 yards to her left. A solenoid jackhammer. Tony Latimer must have decided which building he wanted to break into next. She became conscious, then, of the awkward weight of her equipment, and began redistributing it, shifting the straps of her oxy-tank pack, slinging the camera from one shoulder and the board and drafting tools from the other, gathering the notebooks and sketchbooks under her left arm. She started walking down the road, over hillocks of buried rubble, around snags of wall jutting up out of the Lois, past buildings still standing, some of them already breached and explored, and across the brush-grown flat to the huts. There were 10 people in the main office of Hut 1 when she entered. As soon as she had disposed of her oxygen equipment, she lit a cigarette, her first since noon, then looked from one to another of them. Old Salim von Almhorst, the Turco-German, and one of her 2 fellow archaeologists, sitting at the end of a long table against the farther wall, smoking his big curved pipe and going through a loose-leaf notebook. The girl ordnance officer, Sachiko Korimetsu, between 2 drop lights at the other end of the table, her head bent over her work. Colonel Hubert Penrose, the Space Force CO, and Captain Field, the intelligence officer, listening to the report of one of the Airdyne pilots, returned from his afternoon survey flight. A couple of girl lieutenants from Signals, going over the script of the evening telecast, to be transmitted to the Cyrano, on orbit 5,000 miles off-planet, and relayed from thence to Terra via Lunar. Sid Chamberlain, the trans-space news serviceman, was with them. Like Salim and herself, he was a civilian. He was advertising the fact with a white shirt and a sleeve.